This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening. Welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
They asked him to put down his backpack, and he reached into the backpack, pulled out a pistol, shot at the police, and injured one of the police officers, and the second officer returned fire and killed him.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Milan describing how Italian police killed a suspect wanted in Monday's terror attack in Berlin. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, all passengers and crew on board a hijacked commercial Libyan flight are now free, and negotiators in the DRC have agreed in principle on a deal that would allow President Kabila to remain in power until the end of 2017. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, all 118 passengers and crew on board a hijacked commercial Libyan flight are now safe on the ground in Malta after the two hijackers surrendered. The Africaia Airways plane was bound for Tripoli but was diverted to Malta after the hijackers threatened to explode hand grenades. The hijackers claimed to be part of a party that supported the late leader Muammar Gaddafi and were seeking political asylum in Europe. One of the hijackers held a Gaddafi-era green flag and told the Libyan TV that they represent the new Al-Fatah party. Police in Milan, Italy, today shot and killed the main suspect of this week's terror attack in Germany. Authorities say a rookie police officer, Lucas Catta, opened fire on Anis Amri after the suspect shot and wounded his partner. Reporters say Amri, originally from Tunisia, died about 10 minutes after being shot. Amri, who was 24, is suspected in the truck attack Monday at a Berlin Christmas market that left 12 dead and dozens injured. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments in Italy. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the latest development while heading to Milan on a train.
Yes, very dramatic scenes in Milan when two police officers stopped Amri for a routine check as he was walking down the street about 6 miles from the centre of the city in a suburb called Sesto San Giovanni. And this happened at about 3 a.m. Media reports quoting one of the police officers said that he told them that he did not have any documents, and they asked him to put down his backpack. And he reached into the backpack, pulled out a pistol, shot at the police and injured one of the police officers. And the second officer returned fire and killed him on the spot. So quite dramatic. And police have said afterwards he was carrying no documents, he had no cell phone, he was carrying a few hundred euros but had nothing else on him to indicate who he was.
So at the initial encounter there, they did not know that he was the suspect from Berlin.
No, they were just doing a routine check on the street, and it was 3 a.m. He was walking down the street. He'd taken a train from southern France across to Turin on the border of Italy and then changed trains and arrived in Milan. But it's interesting that he'd ended up in this neighborhood because this is where they believe that the truck that was used in the fatal Berlin attack actually came from. So now people are asking, what sort of connections did he have in this particular area and why did he come back here?
I understand that you have been out and speaking with people in the area. What are they saying?
Well, it was a huge shock. This is quite an industrial neighborhood. It's very multicultural. So there are people there, migrants who've moved there from all around the world, from Latin America, from North Africa, from Eastern Europe. And one Italian man I spoke to, an elderly pensioner, told me that he heard the shots and thought it was firecrackers at 3 a.m. as he was going to the bathroom. And when he went out onto his balcony, he couldn't see a thing. But then others told me as they were arriving for work at the station, for example, one of the women who worked in the cafe there said she was horrified when she arrived to see the body and the blood on the ground in the piazza. And, of course, police were everywhere.
At this point, what are police doing regarding the investigation into his background? I understand that he served some time in prison in Sicily.
There's a great deal of concern in Italy about his connections and whether there's any sort of connection from his time in Sicily. He came to Italy, arrived in Lampedusa in 2011. He was charged and convicted of arson in relation to a migrant centre where there was a fire. He and two others were convicted. And he spent 4 years in different prisons in Sicily. They had to keep moving him around because he was so troublesome. He was violent to other prisoners and so difficult. And when he left prison in Sicily, the Italian government wanted to send him back to Tunisia, but he didn't have a passport, and there was some issue where the Tunisian government refused to accept him. So from there, it appears he went from Italy into Germany. Now there's a great deal of debate about the borders, the border controls, the number of migrants coming into the country, and the fact that it's so difficult for authorities to monitor people when they move around the borders of Europe.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with Kim Lewis from Milan, Italy. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, negotiators have agreed in principle on a deal to end the political turmoil in the country. Reuters says the agreement would allow President Kabila to remain in power until the end of 2017. In return, the constitution would not be changed to allow Kabila to seek re-election. Kabila's mandate expired Tuesday, but he has not stepped down. He was supposed to remain in power until the outcome of the elections that were originally scheduled for last month. However, they were postponed until at least April. The UN Human Rights Office reports that at least 40 people were killed in protest violence this week in the DRC, and about 460 were arrested. The killing of civilians occurred in 4 cities, including the capital, Kinshasa. The UN says more than 100 people were injured. The demonstrations were held to protest President Kabila's refusal to leave office. The UN Security Council has failed to pass a resolution to impose an arms embargo on South Sudan. The Council failed to get the 9 votes needed for approval. The vote was 7 in favor of the arms embargo, with 8 abstentions. Russia and China both abstained. The resolution had been drafted by the United States. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz, on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Huhib in Washington. Fourteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. All passengers and crew on board a hijacked commercial Libyan flight are now free. The Tunisian man suspected of carrying out the attack on a Berlin Christmas market has been shot dead by police in Milan, Italy. And negotiators in the DRC have agreed in principle on a deal that would allow President Kabila to remain in power until the end of 2017. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. An Ebola vaccine was 100% effective in a major study in Guinea. Health officials say they will be better prepared for the next outbreak. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
As Ebola began tearing through Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia in 2014, health workers could do nothing but isolate victims to try to stop the epidemic. So final results from the first major study of an Ebola vaccine mark a turning point. The World Health Organization led the study of more than 11,000 people divided into two groups, says Ebola Research Chief Marie-Paul Kenny, reached by Skype.
We had zero case of Ebola in the group that was vaccinated immediately versus 23 cases in the ones who were not vaccinated. So it's zero as compared to 23, and you can say that this vaccine must be pretty efficacious.
A handful of vaccines are in various stages of testing, but Kenny's group got final results first by using a unique strategy. The epidemic was waning by the time vaccines were ready for testing. The shrinking number of cases made it hard to test their preventive powers. So her study focused on people around those already sick with Ebola.
And it identified from this Ebola case all the contacts, the one who have been in contact with the diseased person, as well as the contacts of these contacts.
Vaccinating this ring of contacts is how smallpox was eradicated. Kenny says it's the first time it's been used to prove a vaccine works. The results, appearing in the medical journal The Lancet, follow promising initial data published in July 2015. The vaccine already has helped stop an Ebola flare-up in Guinea earlier this year. The manufacturer, Merck, is applying for approval from regulators.
There's a good level of preparation already now, and we hope that that this will come to another degree of preparation when the vaccine is registered.
The health nonprofit Gavi has agreed to buy 300,000 doses once approved, but Kenny cautions there's another strain of Ebola that this vaccine is not designed to prevent, and health officials need to be ready to fight the inevitable next outbreak. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Barack Obama was the second U.S. president to oversee PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for aid relief. The program started under George W. Bush and is considered a great success in the battle against the disease. VOA's Jody Capua reports on Obama's PEPFAR legacy.
The president's emergency plan for AIDS relief began in 2004 with a five-year, $15 billion commitment. The legislation creating it set funding priorities, including treatment, prevention, palliative care, and support for orphans and other children affected by HIV. The 2017 budget request for PEPFAR is nearly $6.8 billion, about $52 billion below 2016 funding. Most of the reduction comes in spending on tuberculosis, which is often a co-infection with HIV. Of the 18 million people currently on antiretroviral treatment, PEPFAR has helped about 11 million of them receive the life-saving drugs. Supporters say PEPFAR, the global fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, and others, have saved millions of lives. While PEPFAR is considered a major accomplishment of President Bush, how has it fared under the stewardship of President Obama? Mitchell Warren, head of the AIDS advocacy organization AVAC, says it's done pretty well.
PEPFAR continues to be absolutely remarkable. If we look back on more than a decade in the AIDS response and over 35 years with the epidemic writ large, what President Obama has done is maintained one of the most important, most impactful programs I think global development has ever seen.
Warren says PEPFAR has grown beyond the Bush legacy.
As Obama's term comes to an end, we now can truly see that PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Response for AIDS Relief, is actually President's plural. It is no longer just a George Bush program that continues. It is truly a program that has continued a legacy of U.S. government and U.S. presidential support.
Nevertheless, he says, it could be better. For example, while 18 million people are on treatment, more than 38 million worldwide are infected.
Is the program perfect? No, no program is. Is the program funded as well as we would like it? No, it could use more resources. But if you look at the return on investment, so to speak, under the 8 years of the Obama administration, President Obama's leadership and the leadership of his two ambassadors, Eric Goosby and Debbie Birx, has actually been remarkable and remarkably good.
Doctors Goosby and Birx each served as the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and presided over PEPFAR. Warren says PEPFAR is getting a good return on its investment because tougher economic times demanded it.
Funding didn't grow as much as we would have liked. It did stay largely flat. One thing to say, though, and this is not to justify a flat budget, but what is impressive is to see how more efficient PEPFAR has become. It was using data in new ways. So even though the funding was flat, over the last couple of years, they were able to do more by looking at new, innovative, more efficient models of delivery.
He's concerned, however, that funding may go from flat to reduced during a Donald Trump administration.
PEPFAR has been a critical bipartisan legacy of now two presidents, and we will push as hard as we possibly can as AVAC and with our partners, both in the U.S. and especially in the recipient countries in Africa, to really ensure that we don't step back from PEPFAR's great gains. And we will certainly be advocating with the Trump administration that this is a program that is delivering one of the greatest returns on investments. Will that message be heard? I don't know.
Warren says there was little, if any, indication during and after the campaign about President-elect Trump's stand on global HIV/AIDS assistance. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Christmas in Zimbabwe will be just another day this year. The festive holiday of the past has been replaced by high unemployment, long lines at the banks, a shortage of cash, and pending school fees. Reporter Kudze Zivanvashi talks to an economist and some residents of Harare about Christmas 2016.
It is a few days away from Christmas and it is almost mid-morning in a supermarket located in the heart of Harare's business district. There are customers, but it doesn't look like the usual Christmas shopping rush. Economist Vince Musewe says this year, Christmas in Zimbabwe will be different.
Typically a busy season, people need to be jumping up and down, they're busy, they're all excited, they've received their bonuses, and people are spending money, but obviously this time people cannot because there's no disposable income.
Formal unemployment rate in Zimbabwe is over 80% and most families have school fees for their children due in January. Musewe says because of this, there is no Christmas to speak of.
So there's absolutely no way you're going to have a festive season. You have to begin to think, are you going to have school fees for January? Then you'd rather save money for January than spend it at Christmas. So we are not absolutely getting any Christmas at all, when it comes to the general kind of the population.
Zimbabwe has had its problems in the past. Musewe says Zimbabwe's wars have worsened over the year.
In 2016, our unemployment increased significantly. We've had serious water issues. Life has been difficult. The fact that we are ending it with no cash in the bank and serious bank dues.
Takunda Zimoyo, a Harare resident, agrees Christmas will be different, but not in a good way.
What makes Christmas this year different from the other Christmases is that, you know, the previous Christmases included a lot of traveling and shopping. And even though I despise spending careless, at least it should be by choice. But then in this environment and economy, it's not really by choice. You are forced not to do anything.
While in the past, Christmas was a time to relax with your family, Zimoyo says that's changed.
Christmas used to be all about taking a break, but now it's not really a break because you're not really sure whether you still have a job to go back to.
Family reunions used to be a Christmas tradition, but too many sons and brothers have left Zimbabwe to find jobs in South Africa. The exchange rate of the US dollar against the South African rand also discourages travel home. Vongani Dube, a Zimbabwean based in South Africa, says it's difficult.
The weakness of the rand has really affected most of the Zimbabweans in South Africa. Trying to send money to Zimbabwe has become a challenge, understand? Because I hear now 100 rand is like $5, understand? And in Zim, $5 is nothing, really. You can't even buy a few groceries that can last you maybe a few days, understand? So it's a challenge.
Enoch Murombezi, a grocery shop owner in the central business district of Harare, says sales are not like Christmas in years past.
There's a slight improvement, but the challenge is people are a bit skeptical. They are not really sure whether they should spend their US dollar.
In the wake of all this, the government has not discussed the possibility of a 13th check for the civil servants who will only be paid after Christmas. Those that have money in the bank will have to dedicate hours to waiting in long lines, and some even sleep outside banking halls to small limited amounts of cash. Christmas used to be a time to buy new clothes and join with family and friends for good food prepared with love. But for most of us, Christmas in Zimbabwe this year will be just another day. This is Kudzai Zunawashe, reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
Doctors throughout Kenya have been on strike for 3 weeks. Public medical practitioners are demanding the government raise their salaries, and now some of their colleagues in private facilities are also refusing to work as a show of solidarity. The nationwide strike has left patients with limited options. Many Kenyans can't afford private clinics. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
45-year-old breast cancer patient Rose Adhiambo has missed her weekly visit to the doctor for the third time this month. She's supposed to have her last round of chemotherapy January 3rd.
What is helping me mostly is the HNIF card. It pays a half of the money, then I pay a little cash for the treatment. So I'm really worried, very worried. And more so, this sickness doesn't need stress. So this strike has really gave me a lot of strength.
Her health insurance card covers about 60% of her treatments, but public health workers have been on strike since December 5th. A single chemotherapy treatment will cost almost double if she has to go to a private hospital. That is too expensive for her.
Only to see a doctor, 6,000, just to explain what is the problem you have. You have not received any drug? I can't afford that. I can't manage that amount. Me, I'll just stay home until the day the doctors will go back to work.
The strike has paralyzed more than 2,500 public health facilities, including Kenyatta National Hospital, where Adhiambo usually goes in Nairobi, and the impact appears to be spreading. On Thursday, about 100 doctors working in Aga Khan Hospital, the biggest private hospital in the Nairobi region, joined the strike for a day in a show of solidarity. Those medical practitioners say the shutdown will continue every Thursday. Doctors are demanding a 300% salary increase. The government has offered to pay monthly salaries of between $1,800 and $4,500, depending on the doctor's rank. The Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union has refused the offer. The union wants the least paid doctor to earn $3,250 per month. The union says this was part of the terms laid out in the Collective Bargaining Agreement, or CBA, signed in 2013. But the Labour Minister says the article on the salaries was suspended and so cannot be implemented. The Union Secretary General Dr. Ouma Oluga says they will not resume work until their demands are met.
All we have been pursuing is terms and conditions of work that are better. And those are enshrined in the CBA that the government signed and for which we are seeking its implementation in full and in arrears.
The government took the union to court in an attempt to compel the doctors to return to work. But on Thursday, a judge declined to rule before the new year, saying he needs to first familiarize himself with the case. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.